And welcome to Austrian Macroeconomics, the second lecture, lecture two. And tonight what we're going to do is to go over the origin of money, the functions of money, how the value of money is determined. It's going to be a lot to cover, but I have quite a few slides up for you. So I think we can go through that. So this is really the first lecture on money. The second lecture will be next week, where we'll bring in the banking system. But this week, we'll just talk about money itself and a number of important features. So let me begin the slide presentation. Where does money come from? Okay, or the question is, what is the origin of money? And money develops from barter. Okay. Initially, there is no money. No one invents it. There isn't some wise old king who gets his wise men together, King Nitwit, and says, well, my people are suffering from problems with barter. It's very inefficient. Please come up with a solution. That is not the way money originated in the real world. Nor did it originate from people getting together, let's say, in the colony of Virginia, in the 1700s, and saying, well, let's all use tobacco leaves because they're widely acceptable. We can just use them to make exchanges. It will make our transactions cost, the cost of finding other people to trade with, much lower. So what we're going to do is present what Carl Menger believed was the way that money originated. And so Menger's theory, okay, Menger was the founder of the Austrian school, is the theory that's most commonly accepted today about the origin of money, even among mainstream economists, though it's being challenged lately in the last few years. So money develops from barter, and there's two problems with barter. One is a lack of coincidence of wants, and the other is a lack of divisibility. The first one is more important, okay? And I illustrate the first one. If you're somebody who has something to exchange, and we'll look at A, okay, in red, in the red font, are the goods that the person does not have but would value more than what he actually has. And the black font is the goods that the person has to offer in exchange. So if A is looking for shoes, okay, he'll find that B has shoes. Let's say he finds someone who actually has shoes, and here's where the double coincidence of wants comes in. Their wants do not coincide, okay? A wants shoes, which B has, but B wants wheat, as you can see. He's allergic to eggs, he breaks out in hives, and so he hates eggs. So that would be direct exchange or barter. So A would be stuck, or he would spend a lot of time, what we call transactions costs, in trying to find someone else that has the shoes that he desires, but doesn't have the and wants also the eggs. Okay, that's one way to do it. Okay, on the barter. But then there's another way. He can go look for a good that's commonly used throughout society, and that everyone will accept. We call a generally marketable good. That was Menger's term, or a generally accepted good. And in this case, let's assume that good is wheat. And there are many people that produce wheat in society. Everybody uses it for a wide variety of foods, bread, pastry, so on. So A goes to C, who is easy to find. There are many C's around. There's many wheat farmers. And he trades the eggs for the wheat. Okay, now, he doesn't value the wheat above the eggs for his own use. Okay, he only buys the wheat in order to re-exchange it for the good that he wants. So now we can go to many people that produce shoes, let's say he goes back to B, but with the full confidence that most people, not all, will accept wheat in exchange for shoes. So in that way, money, or rather, we don't have money yet, wheat serves as a medium of exchange. That is, it's not purchased initially for direct use, okay? It allows him to re-exchange it, to engage in a second exchange, and that's why we call it indirect exchange. So indirect exchange using a medium of exchange, like we in this society, is much more efficient or has lower transactions costs, even though it seems less direct, and it is less direct. So wheat serves as a medium of exchange. Let me just mention the divisibility problem. Let's say someone has a cow and wants to buy shoes and a shirt and wants eggs and wants a hat and berries and many other goods. Now the cow, let's assume it's a dairy cow, is only valuable because it produces milk. So that cow is indivisible. Under barter, he would have to find someone who not only wants a dairy cow, but has the whole list of goods that he would like to have in exchange, and that would be nearly impossible. So if you cut up the cow and try to give each person, assuming again they want for dairy cow, you would destroy the value of the cow. That's the problem of a lack of divisibility. So what you would do is then is to go and sell the cow, let's say for 100 bushels of wheat, use the wheat as a medium of exchange, and then go find the 10 or 11 different specialists in producing the different goods he wants and exchange the wheat for the goods. Okay. And there were many media of exchange in history. I just put up a few here. Cattle in ancient Greece. Leather was used in Rome. A number of different items were used in the American colonies, including, as I mentioned before, tobacco leaves in Virginia. Among American Indians, even American Indians had a medium of exchange. They used wampum. The story is told that Manhattan Island was purchased by the Dutch from an Indian tribe for $26 worth of beads. And as a curiosity, in ancient Egypt, cattle were used, but so were wives were exchanged. Women were a little better than property in ancient Egypt, so they were actually used as a medium of exchange. And then there's a famous story of the cigarettes in German POW camps, which became a medium of exchange. What happened was that there would be care packages, Red Cross packages, sent every month to the prisoners, and it would have commonly used items like razor blades, chocolate, cigarettes, underwear, a number of other types of things. And not everybody wanted all these things. Some people may not have wanted chocolate and may have valued more razor blades or something. But everybody smoked cigarettes pretty much in those camps. If you've seen old World War II movies, you know, everybody's a smoker. In any case, given that those were the conditions, what the American POWs did was if you wanted chocolate, if you wanted to trade chocolate for razor blade, but somebody didn't want your chocolate, though they had the razor blade, you would simply trade the chocolate to someone else in exchange for cigarettes. And then you would find that everyone accepted cigarettes, so you could buy the things that you wanted. Okay. Now, money is defined as the general medium of exchange, which means that everybody in society, if you think of the dollar bill, the Federal Reserve note, in today's world, everybody routinely and universally accepts the dollar. No one thinks twice about accepting the dollar in today's world. Now, how do we get to that point? How do we get to the point where something that no one intends to use directly, you know, unless they're misers and they like to fondle their dollars late at night or something, but no one will use it directly. How do we get to the point where people are willing to sell very valuable things, diamonds, automobiles, houses, for these pieces of paper? Well, that's where money comes in. Okay, so we have to talk about money becoming the general medium of exchange. Okay, that is that everyone in society accepts it. And that's done through a self-reinforcing process that I mentioned here. So if a number of people in a society that is initially a barter society are successful in satisfying their wants through indirect exchange, for exchanging, for example, for wheat, for exchanging everything for wheat, and then taking the wheat and then purchasing the things they want, at that point, the value of wheat begins to go up, because now it's demanded not only for direct use, but as a medium of exchange. And that will be emulated by other people that in society who see that these people are successful. So it'll be a process of emulation. As more and more people start using wheat for a medium of exchange, it will be even more widely accepted. And if it's more widely accepted, it makes an even better medium of exchange. So then more people begin using it as a medium of exchange. It goes into wider acceptance, and then it becomes an even better medium of exchange, And eventually, through the self-reinforcing process, one or two goods emerge from barter as money, okay, money being defined as the general medium of exchange. And money solves the problems of barter, as well as having other features that we're going to talk about. I define money as the general medium of exchange. Another thing that's important about money is that it always originates as a useful commodity. Okay, historically, money always comes into being as a commodity money, whether it be cigarettes, gold, silver. Okay, it never comes into being, never comes into existence as a piece of paper, a piece of fiat currency. Okay, it can't originate that way. Whether through a social contract, by everybody getting together in a town meeting and agreeing to accept some kind of piece of paper, or by the government mandating that this thing is money. And the reason why it cannot originate that way logically is precisely because no one knows what the purchasing power of a dollar is. No one knows how much a dollar buys. With gold and silver and cigarettes and tobacco leaves, since they are used under barter, since they are exchanged under barter, they have a pre-existing price in all other commodities. So they have what we call a purchasing power, okay, a pre-existing purchasing power. So when people accept them as a medium of exchange, they already know that they can buy certain things in certain quantities. That is not the case with paper money, and that's why money logically cannot ever come into being as a purely fiat currency. And then the subsidiary functions of money. When people get money, they don't usually or generally spend it all immediately. So if you earn a salary or wages, you don't rush out and spend everything as soon as you get it. The reason is that there's a certain timing to your consumption patterns that you may not find the things that you want right away. So money operates as a store of value. That is, you keep it in your possession. We call money, the money that an individual holds or owns, we call their cash balance, which I didn't write down there, I should have done. It's a cash balance because it's the balance of their income that's left over from them spending, and it's held in cash for future purchases. Okay. And secondly, money is a unit of account, or as the Austrians would put it, a tool of economic calculation. What that means is that under barter, it's very difficult to figure out if you're making profits or losses. Okay, if you have something like 4,000 or 5,000 goods in a barter economy, that works out to be something like 100,000 prices, okay, or hundreds of thousands of prices. The typical supermarket in the United States today has 27,000 items in it. So under barter, each of those items would have a price in 26,999 other goods. So there'd be 26,999 prices. Okay. So imagine how many prices you would have to keep track of. Plus, there wouldn't be any common denominator, right? You couldn't figure out, I mean, you'd sell your razor blades and you'd get chocolate and other things. You get chocolate and you buy berries and so on. But you couldn't figure out your costs and your revenues, okay? With in a monetary economy, that's easy to do, okay? You sell your things for dollars and in exchange, you give the good over, and then you use the dollars to purchase labor services, and other inputs into the production of, let's say, the cars that you're making. Okay. Also, it's very difficult to pay workers under barter. As Murray Rothbard pointed out, if you have you sell automobiles, how do you pay your workers? Do you, pay them in parts of the automobile? And they can only use so many automobiles, and if you try to pay them in parts of the automobile, well, the automobile wouldn't have any value to them. So money's function as a tool of economic calculation is extremely important. And these functions are always subsidiary. They aren't the primary function. The primary function is the general medium of exchange. Once people begin to accept something as a general medium of exchange, they automatically start to price things in it, so it becomes a unit of account, and they automatically begin to hold quantity of it, okay, to make future exchanges. And these are the qualities of a good medium of exchange or good money. as I mentioned, it has to be generally acceptable. And as gold and silver, which did emerge as the globally accepted media of exchange, and therefore became money, they were generally acceptable in almost all cultures for jewelry, for ornamentation, for the aristocrats embroidered their clothing with gold and silver. It had certain industrial uses, and it also had religious uses. It was used in religious rituals, gold and silver. So it was widely accepted. It should be naturally scarce. Okay, that is, it shouldn't be easy to reproduce. And the reason why is because it's very difficult to carry around money that's not, that whose underlying commodity is not scarce. So therefore money has to be portable, which means it has a high value to weight ratio. For example, for a while iron was money in parts of Africa, North Africa, but iron has a very low value to weight ratio. So let's say you wanted to buy a lawnmower. That lawnmower, let's say, might cost you $200, and let's assume you're on a gold standard or an iron standard. So for iron, if you're on an iron standard, that would take about one full ton of iron, okay, $300 per ton of iron. But under gold standard, it would take, you know, a fraction of an ounce, one-sixth, one-fifth of an ounce of gold to purchase. So it would be very difficult to carry iron around. It also should be homogeneous. That is, all units are identical to one another, so that it's easy to distinguish what is and what isn't money, which leads to the visibility issue. Many things have a very high portability. For example, emeralds, diamonds, precious gems are very, very portable. But they don't make good monies, okay? Though they probably were used as media of exchange in the East, Far East. For very large purchases, but they dropped out as a money. And the reason is that, first of all, diamonds all have different values. Each diamond is unique, which is one of the reasons why it's used as a token of an engagement, so to show the loved one that, in fact, you know, they're unique. So, but for money, that makes it very difficult to figure out the value of a particular diamond. And also, the divisibility issue comes in here. Whereas if you cut up gold, divide gold into very small units, every unit of gold retains its prorated value. That is, if you have a bar of 100 ounces, if you break that bar up to 1 ounce each ounce is identical, chemically identical to every other ounce, and therefore they all have the same value on the market. Okay, but if you try to break a diamond up, you destroy the value of the diamond, whereas you don't destroy the value of the gold. The good also should be durable, which is one of the reasons why we don't use fish or ringdings or Twinkies. Even if they're widely used, they'll perish. So that you can't hold them in your cash balance for any period of time. So dried fish was used for a while, but I mean, that dropped out of the competition for money. And finally, it should be pretty recognizable. Gold certainly is. There is something that looks like gold. It's called fool's gold. If you happen to see old Western movies, you would see cowboys, when they accept the gold, biting into the gold. Because gold itself is very malleable, okay, real gold. Fool's gold, which looks very much like gold, is very, very firm, and you don't make your teeth do not make an indentation in it. Also, they're very simple chemical tests to determine if gold is counterfeit or not. So gold and silver combine all of these qualities of good money. So the market chose those media of exchange as money that combine all of these qualities. Here's some common confusions about money that you have to guard against. Money is not wealth. Okay, when you say someone is rich, that does not mean that someone has a lot of money. The rich person may have a huge house, swimming pool, a collection of antique cars, a big stock market portfolio, but at the moment he may not have much cash on him. Okay, so money's not wealth. Wealth is simply, he is rich though, because, or wealthy, because wealth is a total estimated market value of the individual's assets. And those assets may or may not include a lot of money. So you have to be careful. Money is a part of wealth, and in most cases, a very small part of wealth. The money that you currently have in your checking accounts and in your pocketbooks and wallets, it's a very small proportion of your total wealth. If you include your home or the equity in your home and other durable consumer goods that you own, as well as your 401k, your pension, and so on. Also, money's not income. Okay, that's all with this debate on taxes. They're talking about taxing the rich, but income is a sum of money that you're paid per unit of time. Okay, that's not money. That's the flow of money over time. So if someone gets paid $100,000, you don't know if that person is rich or not unless you know the unit of time. If it's $100,000 over a year, then that person's making a nice salary. If it's $100,000 per speaking engagement, okay, that person's making that person does have a very, very high income. Okay. So don't get money confused with income. Okay. Money is the amount of cash that exists in the economy right now. So we can figure out the money supply of all of us that are involved in this course right now simply by counting up, and I'll get this in more detail, the amount of cash that we have, the currency that we're holding, okay, in our pockets or elsewhere, and the amount of money in our bank accounts, okay, the balances in our bank accounts. Summing all of that together for the 250 people in this course, that's the money supply. That we call that the AM1, the Austrian macroeconomics, or AMM1, money supply. So income is not money. Income is money that is a sum of money that changes hands over a period of time. Okay. Nor does money circulate. We always talk about money circulating. But if you think about it, money is simply property like any other property. We don't talk about houses circulating. We don't talk about eggs circulating or computers. Okay. They're bought and sold. Well, so is money. Money is bought and sold. Okay. If I were to buy this very nice Apple computer from Danny, or actually the Mises Institute, it wouldn't circulate. At one moment, the Mises Institute would own it, and at the very next moment, when the money passed from my hands to the hands of Lou Rockwell, the computer would be instantaneously mine. Okay? There's never a period when any piece of property is unowned in the market economy, and that goes for money. Okay? So, if you want to put it this way, money's always lying idle in someone's cash balance. That is, it's always owned by someone. It doesn't circulate. You can use the word circulation, or you can use the term circulate for money in a metaphorical sense, okay? But it doesn't literally circulate, so that's wrong, okay? In fact, money's utility or the satisfaction you get from money is from holding it. Okay, because it allows you to make future purchases. It also guards against against uncertainty that will occur, opportunities to make a good purchase somewhere. You see a sale and you have the money ready to purchase it. Or if there's a medical emergency, or some other type of an emergency, and you have money on hand. It's the fact of having the money on hand that gives you the utility, not the spending of it. When you spend it, you're giving it away to something you value more. So monetary unit, under commodity money, which is how money came into existence as commodity, as we talked about, the monetary unit is nothing more or less than the weight of gold. Okay, it's defined as the weight of gold. So, for example, the U.S. dollar was defined for 100 years, from 1834 to 1933, by law as about 1/20th of an ounce of gold. Okay, which is equal to 23.22 grains of gold. That's how it was defined. And the British pound, for again about 100 years, was legally defined as 1/4 of an ounce of gold. The French franc, for a number of years in the 19th century, the 20th century, was defined as 100th of an ounce of gold. So all these countries, they didn't have different monies. The franc was not a different money from the pound, which was not a different money from the dollar. Okay, all of them, okay, all of those countries had gold as a money. They were just simply, their units were simply different weights of gold. Okay, so there was no real exchange rate. Okay, for 100 years, the exchange rate of the pound was $4.86 per pound, plus or minus 1% for shipping the gold, transporting the gold. Now what was the reason for that? Well, it's the same reason why a nickel, you have to, or 5 nickels exchange for 1/4, because a nickel is defined as 1/20th of a dollar, and a quarter is defined as 1/4 of a dollar. So if you divide, if you take 1/4 and divide it by 1/20th, you get 5. So there's 5 nickels in, or there's 5 times the amount of dollars in a quarter as there are in a nickel. And the same is true of pounds and dollars. There's 5 times the amount of gold in a pound, or there was, as it was in a dollar. Therefore, you had to give about $5 for the pound. And in fact, no one really worried about whether you had pounds or dollars. You could go to Great Britain with dollar coins, okay? All they cared about was the weight. Okay? So it was the weight that counted. Because they could always take it to their mint and have it remelted into pounds. Remelted or reminted into pounds, excuse me. So there's different kinds of money. The two main kinds, and there's actually a third kind which I don't want to get into, is the commodity money, and that's a tangible good that's supplied by the market. So its quantity is controlled by market forces of supply and demand. And there's fiat money, which is a paper money, usually. It doesn't have to be. For a while in French Canada, the money used was playing cards. That is, they stamp on playing cards, on decks of cards, they stamp a certain denomination. And it was government paper money. The government promised eventually to redeem it in gold. But at the time, it was not a gold money. It was paper money. And most fiat money are under the control of legal tender laws, which means that they must legally be accepted for all debts, public and private. It says that on the U.S. Federal Reserve note that we have, or the notes that we carry around. And the government accepts, the public part of that is that they're always acceptable for taxes. Okay. And also, if you incur a debt in terms of dollars, you can pay in this paper money. You can discharge your debt in paper money. Despite the fact that paper money may have lost a tremendous amount of, let's say, purchasing power in the meantime because of inflation. So I'm not going to go too much into how fiat money came into existence. That's more a question for a money and banking class, and this is really a macro class, but I'm just going to say a few things about it. It is the historical conclusion of the debasement of commodity money. Okay, kings to increase the revenues so they could build more palaces and fight more wars would generally call back the coins. Okay. Using the excuse or the pretext that, well, we want to remint the coins because it's becoming underweight. That is, the gold does wear. Silver, to some extent, also wears, not as much as gold. And so what they would do, though, is they pull back, let's say, 1 ounce coin. Let's say it was King Nitwit, and the coin would be called one nit, and that would be 1 ounce. What he would do is he'd remint it at 3/4 of an ounce, and he'd still call it one nit. And so you could pay off your debts with that one nit. Of course, you'd be a ripoff of the creditor. But what would he do with the other 1/4 of an ounce? Basically, he would remint it into more nits for himself. Okay, and eventually, these coins would become very, very small over time. Okay, until people have accepted the name as the actual money, rather than, unfortunately, the commodity. Okay, and then with fiat money, you get a pure name. So the dollar bill is a fiat money. The name dollar is, that's really all fiat money is. It's simply the pure name. And that name is monopolized by the central bank or the government. So in the U.S., no one can affix the name dollar to anything and purport that it's money. The U.S., if it, the Federal Reserve wish could use file folders, it could use cups like this, and if they put $100 on these styrofoam cups, legal tender, it would be legal tender. Okay, it's not the material that counts. Okay, it doesn't have to be paper. Okay, it's any material that the name is legally affixed to as money. So therefore, a fiat money can be created practically without cost. So if you have a $100 bill or a $20 bill, that bill costs about 9 cents, last I looked, to produce. Okay. So the tendency is for all goods in a market economy to fall to their cost of production, be driven down to cost of production. Okay. And certainly that's the case with fiat money. And when you have a hyperinflation, which we will talk about in more detail later on, which is extremely rapid inflation, prices officially defined by the mainstream economists as prices rising at 50% per month, but it can reach 100, price can be doubling every day or even every hour, which is what occurred at the end of the great German hyperinflation in 1921-23. Okay, and at that point, right, prices explode towards infinity and the currency breaks down. Meaning that no one, an infinite price is a price, or is what we call a transaction where no one is willing to accept the whole money supply in the country and even exchange, well, let's say, one egg for it or something like that. And that's what was happening in Germany, okay? Where farmers would refuse even trillions of marks for, a dozen eggs. Okay, now I want to get to the value of money. The value of money is not the interest rate, okay? The interest rate is the price of future goods and present goods, okay? So it's not the price of money. It's the price you have to pay to get present goods today. So if you're going to lend me, if I ask you to lend me $10,000, I have to give you more than $10,000 if I promise to pay that 1 year from now. That's because of the law of time preference. That is, that we value goods and satisfactions today to the same satisfaction in the more remote future. So the interest rate arises as a result of exchange between present goods and future goods, or present money and future money, which is on the loan market. But the value of money, the value of a dollar, is whatever you can buy for a dollar. Okay? Just as under barter, the value of a cow, if you can sell it for two horses, the purchasing power of a cow is two horses, or let's say you could also get five plows for the cow. So it's either two horses or five plows, or many other things. So there are many, many values for a good under barter. But if you think of it, the dollar bill is the only good, or if we're talking about gold, the gold ounce is the only good in a monetary economy that is still in a state of barter. So every other good in a monetary economy has one price, okay? And that price is always in terms of money. But money itself exchanges for the whole array of goods that are produced in the market economy. So money is still in a state of barter in that sense. Okay, it has many different prices. So I've taken a very simple economy here, one that has Coke, pizza, iPods, and laptops, okay? So let's say those are the corresponding prices that you see there on the screen. Now that means that the purchasing power of money, or the price of money, or sometimes it's called the value of money, is fourfold. That is, there's a Coke price of money. It's one Coke per dollar. This is the dollar for Coke. Or there's also a pizza price per dollar for the dollar. Okay, you can either get one Coke, or one tenth of a pizza, or 1/100 of an iPod, or 1,000th. 1/1,000th of a laptop for a dollar, okay? That array, that list of things that you could purchase for a dollar is what we call the purchasing power of money, or the PPM, okay? You can also call it the value of money, as long as you keep in mind we talk about the market value or the exchange value of money. So what happens then if prices double? Okay, when prices double, the purchasing power of money, or when prices go up at all, the purchasing power of money falls. okay? And you can see that under in the second part of the slide, okay? Note that I assume that all prices double. But that means then that each dollar buys less than it did before. Before it bought one Coke, now it buys only half a Coke. Before it bought 1/100th of an iPad, now it buys 1/200th of an iPad, okay? So there's the popular saying that inflation causes the dollar to shrink is what is meant. I mean, or it is true in the sense that as prices go up, the purchasing power of money falls. Okay, what the dollar can buy shrinks. So think of it this way, that the movement of prices is inverse to the movement of the purchasing power of money. When one goes up, the other goes down. Okay. When prices drop, which is a great thing, and which is usually happens in a market economy where you don't have paper money, it means that each dollar buys more. Okay? So what we say is that when the dollar rises in value, it's appreciating. A dollar appreciates when prices fall. It depreciates when prices rise. And that, or we call that inflation also. Okay, how do we measure the money supply? Under commodity money, it's fairly straightforward. I have a definition there. But it's basically the total amount of monetary gold in existence in the economy. So there are coins and ingots and bullion. All of the gold that has been fashioned into monetary forms constitute the money supply. The gold in the form of jewelry and you know, in people's teeth, in the form of religious articles, but that is not part of the money supply. Okay, though it can be turned into, can increase the money supply, depending on the movement in the purchasing power of money. So then, it's simply then, it's the total weight of monetary gold in the economy. And you can figure that out by finding out each individual's cash balances, and note I have a small m here, I'm going to use pointer, that small m, That refers to or designates each individual's cash balance. You sum all that up, that's a sum symbol, and you get the total money supply under a gold standard, as an example. Things get more complicated, however, when we introduce fiat money. So there are a number of official Fed definitions of the money supply, or they're called monetary aggregates. Okay, that is aggregating all the money in the economy. M1, which used to be one that was the most commonly used, is the currency plus demand deposits plus traveler's checks and other checkable deposits. They're deposits that you may earn interest on or that you can withdraw that are not at commercial banks, that may be at credit unions and so on. They're known as other checkable deposits. Okay, the key is that in addition to currency, M1 really includes all checkable deposits in banks, okay, and thrift institutions, credit unions and savings and loan institutions. M2 includes everything that's in M1 and then adds in money that you can pretty much withdraw at will, okay, even if you can't write checks on your accounts. And they include savings deposits, small-time deposits. Now, that is something that we also know as certificates of deposit, okay, which have maturities running from 3 months up to 2 years, I believe, which means you cannot withdraw it immediately. And then, as we'll see, as Austrians, we reject including that money supply. Also, retail money market mutual funds that allow investments for less than $100,000. Austrians would also, which I'll talk about in a moment, reject money market mutual funds as part of the money supply. And there's a few minor categories. We usually use M2 or MVM, the broader money supply aggregates, when we're analyzing the economy. And MVM is for money of zero maturity. It's quasi-Austrian. What they try to do is to get rid of the money that's not readily available to be spent. So they subtract, if you'll note here where I have the arrow, small-time deposits are subtracted out of M2, okay? But then they add in institutional money market funds, which are money market funds in addition to the retail ones. These are ones that only permit people to invest more than $100,000. Okay, it seems like you can write, and I misspelled institutional there. It seems like you can write checks on these things, but actually you're not writing checks on the money market mutual fund itself. Okay, you're writing checks on a bank that the money market mutual fund has its deposits at. They only keep about 0.5% in cash. So money market mutual funds, for various reasons, are not part of the money supply, and I'll get to that now. And this is I have Salerno's true money supply here. I wrote an article on this. Actually, I got this from Murray Rothbard. I developed it more, but you could see the basis of the true money supply in his book, America's Great Depression, and then in an article that he wrote in a book in 1976. And I don't recall the title of that article, maybe the Austrian money supply. But what we do then is to take M2 and then subtract out all money market mutual funds, all small time deposits, okay, for the reasons I mentioned before. And I'll come back to money market mutual funds for a moment. And then we add in something that used to be in the U.S. money supply, for example, U.S. government deposits. Okay, when you pay your taxes, the U.S. Treasury deposits money in commercial banks and at the Fed. And when they do their spending, when they spend those taxes, they write checks. That's part of the money supply. For some reason now, since World War II, it hasn't been included. It should be included. It's not a very big item, but it should be included. Plus demand deposits at American banks, U.S. banks, and also at the Fed that are due to foreign commercial banks and official institutions. That is a bank in, a British bank or the British government, they're holding deposits here in the U.S. For some reason, even though they're dollar deposits, they're not included. We include them, as we do with time and savings deposits that can be readily withdrawn by foreign banks and official institutions. But mainly, the true money supply is M2 minus money market funds and small time deposits. Okay. And here's the logic of calling only those items the true money supply that I specified. So for something to be part of the money supply, from the Austrian point of view, okay, but remember, the Austrian point of view, something to be money has to be readily spendable, has to be immediately spendable, okay? So one, it must be routinely and universally accepted in exchange for goods and services, okay? So certainly U.S. currency, the Federal Reserve note, qualifies as part of the money supply, and it must serve as a final means of payment in all transactions. Okay, so that's why we don't include, for example, credit cards. Okay, you pay with the credit card; it's accepted. Okay, in most places, if not universally. However, it's not the final means of payment. Okay, what it is an instant loan to you, with which you pay the retailer. But the retailer then keeps the slip and sends the slip to a bank and then gets his account credited with the dollars, okay, that the bank has loaned. And then the bank turns around at the end of the month and charges your account, okay, for that instantaneous loan that they did. Okay? So you're not off the hook until you pay your credit card bill. Okay? So for something to be money, it must be the final payment. It must finally discharge all your debts. Or, okay, so far we only have cash in here. Okay, or it must be an instantly convertible claim to cash, okay, the general medium of exchange, the U.S. Federal Reserve note, which means that it must be interchangeable with money or with currency at par on demand. Okay, so that is to say that if you have $10,000 in a checking account, you must have the right to withdraw that. You must be able to withdraw that completely and fully, the full $10,000, without any charge, and immediately. Okay, and since that's true of savings accounts, even though you can't write a check on it, you can go to an ATM, you can go to the bank itself, you can withdraw all the money. Austrians include savings accounts. We don't include certificates of deposit because they have maturity that is not immediate. That is, you have to wait 3 months, 6 months, and two or 2 years, whatever it is. Sometimes banks will allow you to withdraw it, but they'll charge you. You'll either lose the interest and maybe part of the principal or you'll lose the interest on it that you've accumulated. Okay, so it's so you're not getting it. You're not converting your claim at par. And now, what about money market mutual funds? Why aren't they part of the money supply? Well, all money market mutual fund is really a managed portfolio. So we all put money in a Fidelity money market mutual fund. The fund itself, the managers, all they do with that money is they collect it and they go out and they buy government bonds or short-term high-grade commercial paper issued by corporations. And they also buy bank certificates of deposit. And usually the maturity is, I don't know, 30, 60 days, whatever it is. But when you write a check on a money market fund, let's say you want to make a down payment on a car, what happens is that check is drawn on the bank. So the check goes to the money market mutual fund bank. They make the payment to the dealer. And then the money market mutual fund sells, let's say, $10,000 worth of assets, okay, and then replenishes their checking account, and then reduces your portfolio by $10,000. Okay, that's one thing. So it's really an investment. It's not money. And the second thing is that money market mutual funds do not call you depositors. You're not a depositor who's you do not have a right to a fixed sum of cash. You have a right. You have an equity claim, meaning you own the underlying assets. So what if suddenly a corporation defaulted on its commercial paper and suddenly the assets were worth 90% of what they were worth before? Everybody then, shareholders, they're called shareholders, in the money market mutual fund would find that instead of having, let's say, $10,000, they would only have $9,000 in their account. Okay, it would be written down. Okay, that doesn't happen when the bank loses money. You still have a claim on the cash of the bank, or rather on the deposits. Okay, which have to be paid off ultimately in currency. Okay. Now let's talk about a little more about the money supply. For simplicity, we're going to use simply currency and demand deposits. Okay, we're going to use M1. But keep in mind that for the Austrian the TMS, it includes not only demand deposits, but all deposits that you can withdraw on demand, not just those that you can write checks on. Okay. So let's go to the next slide, which in a fiat money world, the money supply is strictly determined by the Federal Reserve, okay? Though you and I, and also the banking system, and we'll see how, do have an influence on the money, on the amount of money in the economy, okay? When you put currency in a bank, for example, or take currency out of a bank, it changes the money supply. But the Fed can always offset that. They have the ultimate say on the size of the money supply. Or the bank, for example, as they do now, if the Fed injects reserves into the banking system, that might not increase the money supply if the banks are afraid of loaning that money out, and so they don't loan the money into existence. They hold it as excess reserves. But the Fed can then add even more reserves, and eventually the bank will make those loans as excess reserves pile up. So we're going to assume that the Fed precisely controls the money supply, and it can set it at whatever amount it wants. That's true in the medium run. In the short run, it's not completely true. Okay, for the most part, it is. So what's the demand for money? Okay. Remember before I said people demand money to hold. Okay. Well, there's two ways of demanding money, and the first way is to buy money. Okay. So when you buy, like when you buy apples or you buy a house, you're exercising your demand for apples or the house. How do you buy money? You buy money by exchanging things for money. You demand money by exchanging things for money. And most of us get most of our money income by exchanging our labor hours for money. Okay, so whenever we go to work, we're demanding money. Okay, we're trading a non-money item, our labor services, for money. If you sell a used car, if you sell something on eBay, you're demanding money. Okay, so that's called the exchange demand for money in Austrian terminology. And then there's another demand for money. Right now, as we sit here, we're all demanding money. to the extent that we're not rushing out and putting our money in a vending machine or trying to buy something else, we're holding money. We all right now have money in our wallets, as I said before, and in our checking accounts, and that is our cash balance. So if you hold a cash balance, you demand money. If you have a zero cash balance, then there is no cash balance demand for money. So there's two forms or two elements or parts of the demand for money. One is the exchange demand, when you buy money by selling other things. And usually, after you buy money, you'll use part of it to buy things, but you'll hold a part. So that second part is your cash balance demand for money. Okay. And as we'll see now, we're going to talk about what determines the value of money. The value of the height of prices, or the price that you have to pay, is going to affect how much money you want to hold in your cash balance. It's going to affect your demand for money. Okay. And I'll show you a diagram. But for now, the law of demand, the quantity of money demanded is negatively related to the value of money and positively related to prices. To put it another way, when the purchasing power of money goes up, when the dollar buys more, people will want to hold fewer dollars. So if all prices were cut in half tomorrow, okay, what would we all do? Many of us, or not all of us, would spend some of the money we're holding in our cash balance. Because if all prices were cut in half, if gas was now $1.50, if milk was now, you know, $2 a gallon instead of $4 a gallon, whatever it is, if computer prices were cut in half, if electricity prices were cut in half, so on and so forth, you wouldn't need to hold as much money to make transactions in the future to buy these things. Okay? So the law of demand, which holds for all goods, also holds for money. Okay? On the other hand, the lower the value of money, that is, the higher prices are, the more money that you're going to want to hold. That's also the law of demand. And of course, that all other things equal. Even if prices don't change, if you have more income, so you can buy more things, you will hold more money, okay? Or if you think prices are going to go up or down, you will hold more or less money, which we'll talk about that. All right, here's a very simple diagram of supply and demand for money. So if you've had the micro part of the course, you've gotten into supply and demand. The only difference here between this graph and the regular supply and demand graph is that we're going to have two axes, one on the left and one on the right. And maybe I'll just get a little bit into before we stop this. Okay. So as the value of money rises, the price level falls, okay, which we talked about before, right? So as the price of something, in this case, the price level is if you move up that axis, the price level is falling because we want to show that the value of money is going up as the price level falls. So the lower price was R. So if the price of something is $4, okay, if you see that on the right here, let me show you. That's $4, okay? That means that the value of money is one-fourth. You can only buy one-fourth of whatever good we're talking about. Let's say it's an ice cream cone. It buys one-fourth of an ice cream cone, okay? But if the price of ice cream cones falls to $1 here, right, then the value of money rises. It buys a full ice cream cone. Okay, so that's how we look at it. And there'll be some more stuff here. So that upward arrow shows that the value of money increases when prices fall. If you shifted those arrows in a downward direction, you would find the reverse occurs. So let's assume in this economy there's $1,000. Where does it come from? The Fed creates it. The fiat money economy. The Fed creates it, and it sets it at $1,000. Okay. How the Fed creates it, we'll talk about next class. Okay. So the Fed doesn't respond to what prices are, just it decides what the money supply should be. And then, let's see here. Let me see if that's, since I thought it was missing, so let me just come back here for a moment. Okay, that for some reason that demand curve is upside down. It should be intersecting here, Okay, this is the man for money. It should be intersecting here. I don't know what happened there. So, yeah, can you excuse me for one moment? He's just right here.
Does it need to be curved?
Yeah, it's got to be. Yeah, just draw it. Just draw the man curve.
I can only do.
It's a straight line. It's a straight line. It doesn't matter.
Okay, pencil is good.
Yes. Okay.
Scribble this one out?
Yes. So Danny Sanchez is fixing this diagram. I don't know what happened to it.
So that means ignore that.
Ignore that, please, yeah.
And then
just a straight line. Fine, or whatever you want. It doesn't matter. As long as it's down sloping and goes through there. Okay. That's a demand for money. Okay. Now, what that says is that as the value of money, so forget the demand curve, the supply curve for a moment, and just look at that demand curve. Notice that as it moves down to the right, let me click back, switch this off. Okay, as it moves down to the right, and let me see if I can get the, I need the pointer back, Danny. Yeah, thanks. So as that demand curve, moves down to the right, it tells us that the lower the value of money is, the more money people need. Okay, so if prices are very, very high, then people need and want to hold much more than $1,000. Let's say they want to hold $3,000 or something like that. Okay, but as the value of money goes up and each dollar buys more, they don't need to hold as much, so the demand falls. So if you notice up here, the demand is less than $1,000. The way this is drawn, maybe it's $500. So at lower prices, people demand less money because it buys more. They don't have to hold as much. And at higher prices, they demand more money. Now, keep in mind that labor is also a good. So the same thing happens to your wages. As the value of money falls, that means the price of labor goes up. So your wages will increase as a result of an inflation or as a result of a rise in prices. All prices increase, and including wages and salaries. On the other hand, if there's a fall of prices, then there's a tendency for the money wages to decrease. So that doesn't have to happen if it's a result of productivity, which we'll talk about. Okay. So this is equilibrium price level. The way I'm drawing this demand curve and giving the supply curve, and I'll explain why this happens. Prices of the good in this economy is $2. And each dollar buys one half of the unit of the good, okay? And the reason is very simple, and I'll end with this, and we'll go back, we'll start with this next week. But if for some reason the price was very high at $4, people would demand much more money than is actually available. There's only 1,000 available. Let's say they're demanding, $2,000 or $3,000 here. Well, how would that adjust? The point is, when people demand more money, they spend less of their income. They try to hold more. As everyone tries to hold more money and spend less, guess what happens? Prices fall. So people continue to hold money, additional money from their income, until prices have fallen to the point where the amount of money in existence, that is $1,000, will be powerful enough in the sense that it has now greater purchasing power. It's gone from 1/4 of a unit of the good to 1/2. It can buy more. Has enough purchasing power that people are satisfied with holding $1,000. On the other hand, up here, you have an excess demand for money, and again, I'll talk about this, an excess supply. People want to, there's $1,000 the Fed is putting to the economy, but people don't need that much, okay? Each dollar buys a lot. So what do they do with the extra money? Well, what you would do if you won the lottery and you suddenly won $1 million, you wouldn't hoard it all in your checking account, okay? You would have more money than you need at the current price level. So you'd spend it. And as people spend the money that they don't want to hold, that will drive prices up. As prices go up, they'll realize, now, I have to hold more than I thought, until the point where, again, there's a demand for $1,000 and there's a supply of $1,000, okay? So we'll stop here. We'll go over that again next week, okay? Just curious, And I'll fix it. I'll dive in myself. Okay. I will stop here, and then we'll take questions. Okay. The question is, what do we do to understand the shadow banking system? the credit and risk created outside the typical banking system, will this be covered in this course? The shadow banking system will not be covered in this course. That would be more of a topic in a money and banking course that focuses more closely on that. The shadow banking system is simply a name for private indebtedness, private derivatives that are created. Okay, the shadow banking system cannot grow tremendously, okay, without the Fed increasing the money supply. The shadow banking system, in a sense, sits on, okay, it's supported by the money supply. But I don't want to go into it much more than that. There's another question. If people seriously believe they can pull equity from their house indefinitely, then the house would then become capital, simply because the person views it as capital. But then, as long as they're no longer able to buy goods with this equity, the house ceases to be capital. Okay, that's a good question. The house is always capital in the sense that it has a value on the market. It's part of your wealth. Okay, it has a capital value. Okay, and that capital value is determined by market conditions. If what you're saying here in this question is if people take all the equity out of the house, then they're just simply left with a liability. Okay, that is all they're left with. They have no more equity in the house, so that you're right, this is not any longer part of their net worth. Okay, you cannot add that in as wealth. Because remember, wealth is all the assets that you own, the value of all the assets that you own, minus the liability that you owe.
You can, when these question marks,
yeah,
you can click on the question.
Okay.
A little to the right. Yeah. Click on that, yeah. It doesn't, okay. Actually, just go here.
Okay. Okay, just give me a minute. I'm having problems with the question. Here we go.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead. Why don't you do it? Okay. Now the questions appeared on the screen. Okay, so here's the question. Did you have an opportunity to read my... No. So a person's cash balance consists of cash on hand, checking account balance, and savings account balances, but not certificates of deposit or money market mutual funds. That's right. Okay. That's exactly what the Austrian would say, or most Austrians would say. There is some controversy over this. For example, I think that George Reisman doesn't accept that savings accounts should be part of the money supply, for example, because you can't write checks on them. And I think that's also true of Larry White. There's a question that asks, is the new money injected into banks from the Fed counted as part of the money supply, or does that not happen until the banks loan it out? If the Fed injects the money through the banking system, okay, it is not money at that point. It's not included as part of the money supply because bank reserves are not included as part of the money supply. Okay, and so you are right that it's only when the banks lend that money out that it becomes part of the money supply. Now, having said that, if the Fed purchases a bond, because that's what they purchase, treasury bonds, and now mortgage-backed security bonds, if they purchase a bond from a dealer that is not a bank, that dealer gets the check, the Fed writes the check on itself, okay, which is it's legally permitted to do, even though it just simply creates that money out of thin air, writes the check on itself, and let's say for $10 million, buys the bond from the bond dealer. As soon as the bond dealer puts that money into the bank, deposits that check in his account at the bank, that becomes more part of the money supply. Okay, the bank counter may or may not loan that money out, 90% of that money out, they're permitted to loan out. They may keep it all in reserves, but still, the $10 is $10 million new dollars in the economy. Okay, depends on who they initially buy the bond from. Another question asks, why, since the money supply has increased with so much, quote, quantitative easing, unquote, are we not seeing the inflation rates of the 1970s? Another very good question. There's a number of reasons for that. First of all, you're focusing on CPI, that is consumer prices. So we are seeing a tremendous explosion in the price of agricultural land in many states of the Midwest. Commodities prices have exploded. They've gone almost back up to the level that they were at before the financial crisis, which was a bubble level. So commodities prices have risen. The stock market went from 8,000 in 2008-07. It's now hovering near 14,000. That was the high point at the height of the bubble. So asset prices do show inflation. Okay. In fact, Mark Thornton has written an article on this. It's today's Mises Daily, in fact, and I highly recommend that article. And other reasons, the banks are in fact holding excess reserves. Okay, a tremendous amount of excess reserves. So not all of the injections into the economy is getting into the money supply, but still the money supply is rising fairly rapidly. Another reason is that there's a big demand for money on the part of people outside the U.S. I mean, drug smugglers use $100 bills in the drug trade, though they don't trust the dollar much anymore, and they're beginning to offload them and use 500 euro notes. Okay, but that I think that stopped last year or the year before because the euro now is in trouble, so they're going back to the dollar. So people in inflationary economies and with high tax economies that want to hide their income are using dollar currency. In fact, 67%, two-thirds of the currency that has been created, the currency, is outside the U.S. Okay, and if you look at $100 bills, 80% of the $100 bills in the economy, 80% of $100 currency bills are circulating outside the economy. That's an estimate that the Fed itself has made. Okay.
Did you read that one already?
Yeah, I just did. There's another question regarding if the gold standard were to be introduced today, would the price of gold drastically drop, or would values in general be thrown into disarray? To answer the first part of that question, if the gold standard were introduced today, there would be a tremendous increase in the demand for gold. So the price of gold in terms of paper money would go up. Okay, so you would have a big increase. People holding gold would have a windfall gain. But if it was a real gold standard, eventually you would want to simply get rid of the name dollar and price things in ounces or grains of gold. The second part of that is, or would values in general be thrown into disarray? I don't know if they'll be thrown into disarray, but going back to a gold standard right now with the U.S., the dollar would become much stronger. What you find is that the dollar would appreciate in value on the foreign exchange market. That is, it would be a lot more expensive to buy U.S. goods, and it would be very, very cheap to buy foreign goods. Okay, and what might happen is that foreigners would buy a lot of our goods up, okay, initially. So I don't want to go into that in too much detail. The transition to the gold standard is a very difficult and tricky subject, and there are other ways of doing it than just simply jumping back to the gold standard. Okay, other ways of having currency competition, allowing people to use gold and silver without the government officially going back, taking all the taxes off of silver and gold, all the excise taxes, capital gains taxes, sales tax, and allow people to use that, and also allow people to have euro accounts at their American banks and Swiss franc accounts. And so with that, we could have competition, and that would put some restraint on the Fed. This question asks, is there any writing on the rate at which prices displaced from equilibrium will return to equilibrium in a free market versus a regulated market? Can that be mathematically modeled to give insight? Has it been modeled? Well, certainly not from the Austrian point of view. These price adjustment models are deterministic. They don't take into account human expectations. So I really don't think there's any way to mathematically model prices. But also, actually, a deeper point about that, prices are never in equilibrium in the market economy. Okay, not in the sense that the mathematical economists talk about. Prices are always, there's always profits and losses to be earned in the economy, okay? And as long as there are profits or losses in the economy, it means that prices are not at their equilibrium levels. They're always changing towards those levels, but they never reach them because there's always another change that changes underlying factors and causes supply and demands to change. Supply and demands to change. How could you determine the rise in the price of precious metals due to demand, I guess a legitimate demand for the precious metals, versus inflation? Well, let's put it this way. If you see that the money supply, defined as TMS or, you know, M2, is not increasing, and there's no change in demand for money, which is kind of hard to pinpoint, but assuming that you don't have any increase in the money supply, and you see the price of gold increasing, well, then you know that's a legitimate demand for gold. It certainly is not an inflation-driven increase in demand. Here's a good question. Some monitors claim that the Fed's current actions are justified because they simply offset declines in monetary aggregates supported by bank money. Why do they seem to focus on different aggregates than the Austrians? I'm not so sure about, I mean, monetary aggregates are rising, okay? But the reason why the monetarists focus on different aggregates is because they believe that money is anything that let's use the word correlates. Okay, moves along with the nominal income. So whatever, for example, if you see nominal income is simply the total amount of money income in the economy. So if that, over the course of a year, let's say, so if that goes up by 10% and the money supply goes up by 9%, or some items go up by 9%, well, that's a pretty good. They would pick those things as money supply. So, for example, if peanut butter and computers and telephones went up by that amount, or were included in an aggregate, they would call that money. So, in other words, they have what's called a very positivist approach to defining money. Austrians define money logically as that good that is universally accepted. Monetarists want to define money as whatever best explains movements in total income in the economy. Okay. And so they're willing to change definitions according to whether or not the aggregate does a good job of predicting the future. And they've moved away from M1 and moved towards M2 in the last 20 years, let's say. Okay, if international reserves determine the value of money, and international reserves are only comprised of gold, why do we say gold determines the value of money? Aren't there other sources of value? Well, international reserves don't determine the value, doesn't determine the value of money. As I'll show you next week, and I started to show you this week, the value of money is simply determined by supply and demand. Okay? That is the price level, or the level of prices in the economy. And the inverse of that, which is the purchasing power of money, is completely determined by supply and demand. Whether it's a gold money, silver money, or any type of commodity money, or fiat paper money. Okay, no money is backed by gold today. Okay, no money is backed by any commodity today, and yet it has a value. It has a value because there's a pre-existing purchasing power. Okay, and in fact, the reason why you can introduce fiat money, paper money, was because when Britain did it in 1931, and the U.S. did it in 1933, and then France and so on did it in 1936, people already, people were used to the name, and each dollar bought a certain amount in the past. So people focused on how much the dollar was worth. They knew how much the dollar was worth, given what it purchased in the immediate past. And so they accepted those dollars as they would a gold dollar. Okay? By that point, the link between the dollar and gold was so weak that it was easy to break. In fact, it wasn't completely broken until 1971. But now, since 71, we have a purely fiat currency. Okay. Here's a question. What do you think would happen economically if productivity were to fall globally in aggregate in a fractional reserve banking system? If productivity were to fall, and I think you're talking about the productivity of goods, I'm not sure, but it means to be fewer goods in the economy and price would go up, okay? That wouldn't be called inflation, though. I mean, it would by the mainstream, but not by Austrians. Simply that goods have gotten a lot scarcer, so their prices are higher. And I don't think that would have much of an effect one way or the other on the fractional reserve banking system. On the one hand, money is all line idle. On the other, bank reserves do not count as money supply. How do these two definitions match? The reason why reserves don't count as part of the money supply, and we'll talk about this next week, but I'll briefly summarize it now, is because initially, let's say you put $100 into the bank, okay? Let's say you put $100 of cash into the bank, and the bank then credits your check account with $100. The $100 in reserves is looked upon as backing up the cash. The check account balance that you have. So it'll be double counting to count reserves and to count the cash. In a fractional reserve bank system, the banks only legally in the U.S. have to hold 10%. So if you put $100 into the bank would hold $10 in reserves, and you would loan out $90 of the rest, the $90. But that $10 is backing up the $100. So you would be double counting to count that $10 as part of the money supply. Okay, it's already included in the $100 as backing for the $100. Okay, if we face a depression where prices would normally fall dramatically, and yet prices stay the same due to the monetary policy as is occurring currently, and you're right, would you consider this inflationary or even hyperinflationary? Well, I wouldn't consider it hyperinflationary, but certainly if the government is madly pumping money in to keep prices from falling, okay, and it's not just during recessions, also in a normal situation, prices should be falling as the economy grows. If you have more and more goods and services, the supply of goods increases, the demand doesn't change, if the money supply doesn't change, and prices should fall, which is what happened in the U.S. economy from 1880, when we went back to the gold standard, to 1896. Prices fell an average of 3% per year. The government, that was fine. But in the 1920s, we had tremendous growth, just like we did after the Civil War, and prices didn't fall at all, and that was very inflationary. Friedrich Hayek, Ludwig von Mises, and then later on Margaret Rothbard looked at this period and said, the Fed is inflating the money supply. And Rothbard calculated that they were inflating the money supply, according to his definition, by between 6 and 7% per year, just to keep prices from falling. That's how productive the economy was. Okay, and yes, that's inflationary, because it artificially lowers interest rates when that new money is injected by the Fed and causes entrepreneurs to begin to invest in areas that they really should not be investing in. Okay. And then we'll talk about that more when we talk about the business cycle. And by the way, on that question, one more point about that. The Austrians tend to use a different definition of inflation. For most people, inflation now means a general rise in prices. For the Austrians, it means an increase in the money supply. So when I refer to inflation, I'll be using the common definition, okay? Or I'll say price inflation. Okay? If I want to use the Austrian use of the word, it would be monetary inflation. Another question asks, in some of Rothbard's works, he mentions that in our current banking system, banks would never carry excess reserves because there's no incentive to do this. Why do we have so much, why do we hear so much about excess reserves today? Well, a number of reasons. Number one, Rothbard didn't deny that banks would hold excess reserves during a depression. And in fact, if you look at American Great Depression, it talks about the excess reserves there. And that's because banks can't find many good risks or people that are creditworthy or firms that are creditworthy to lend to. But in a normal situation, Rothbard would have said then that banks will not hold excess reserves. One of the reasons why the excess reserves are being held today is still that there's still not a lot of good risks in this economy, but another reason is that the Fed has began during the financial crisis to pay banks to hold excess reserves. That used to be illegal. The law was changed, so they're able to pay banks 0.25% to hold excess reserves. Okay, and that's, you know, many banks feel that that's really better than they can do with the risk of default in today's economy. Okay. But they but the money supply is increasing now. You know, it's increasing at a rapid rate. So some of these excess reserves are being worked off. And if the money supply, if banks tried to loan all these excess reserves out, it would be a massive inflation, which the Fed would stop initially by maybe raising the amount that they pay on excess reserves to 0.5% or 1%, which is, you know, which is a good income for banks just by keeping your money idle and without any risk. Someone asked if I've ever read George Soros' book on the alchemy of finance and seen some of his theories, that markets can very much move away from equilibrium. Any thoughts about his theories? I think he calls his theory reflexivity. I really haven't read any of his books, so I'm not sure what he means by moving away from equilibrium. And also, he would simply say that equilibrium is only a mental tool, it's a mental experiment that allows you to separate interest from profits. Okay. Austrians don't really think that in the real world markets move towards equilibrium. Okay. Entrepreneurs produce goods that they believe will best satisfy consumer demands. There's competition. Prices arise. They're not equilibrium prices. They're the outcome of supply and demand. The only way we would use or talk about equilibrium in the real world is simply market clearing. At any given moment, all the goods that entrepreneurs are willing to sell at the darn price will be sold. So supply will equal demand in that sense. Okay. So in that sense, you talk about equilibrium. But I'd rather talk about market clearing prices. Here's a question on aggregates. And it says, if aggregate economic measures like GDP can't be calculated and are not relevant, how would Austrians know whether we are facing a fluctuation in the business cycle? What measures would you use to determine the growth of the economy? Well, we're not saying that aggregates aren't useful for historical purposes, that is, for evaluating what has happened in the economy. So we use the money supply as an aggregate. In fact, it's a good aggregate because they all are homogeneous units. Regarding GDP, where they try to add up all the different hundreds of thousands or millions of services and goods in the economy, that's like adding apples and oranges. So you can't use that for theory, but you can use that, some of these aggregates, to give you an idea of what is happening. Regarding whether or not these are useful in trying to figure out if you have a business cycle, there are other things that used to be used that were much more homogeneous. For example, just the amount of iron that was produced, or steel, something that was crucial to the economy, that was used in many products. Or just industrial output in general. These didn't have as many problems. But still, again, aggregates can have problems and still be useful. Okay, again, but for history, not for making economic policy, not for coming up with theory. Someone noted that, or asked that, a friend noted that the price of gas at the pump does not appear to move according to supply and demand. Prices seem to jump around almost randomly. The demand is somewhat inelastic. Why the price jumps? Why does the price jump? Can you relate to supply and demand? Well, the demand for any one gas station isn't inelastic. It's very elastic. But for all gas, yeah, it is inelastic. Okay. We're lucky because there's competition among brands, and that keeps the price down. I don't see the price not moving according to supply and demand. I mean, you can usually see that when oil becomes more scarce, or when there's a scare in the Middle East, or when the U.S. talks about bombing some country, or there's a fear that they will in the Middle East, oil prices jump, and then shortly thereafter, gasoline prices rise. Okay, and also certainly in the U.S. when during the summer, vacation season, the demand for gasoline goes up because people drive more during that period, you would see prices rising. Okay? But there are many factors involved, both on the supply side and the demand side. Okay? So I don't know what you're getting at by saying it doesn't move according to supply and demand. Okay. It might seem, for example, in dollar stores or in Walmart that prices don't move according to supply and demand. Okay. But in fact, there's a reason to keep prices stable when supply and demand changes, and for the sellers to hold on to the inventory. So if they don't raise their prices when their inventory is running down, it means that they expect that people are buying more this week and will buy less next week, so they don't need as much. Okay? Or movie theaters, they almost never change their prices. They change it very infrequently. But again, there's something to supply and demand. And the hidden thing about movie theaters, of course, is that they have concessions. And they sell popcorn and soda and many other types of candy and so on. And what they do there is they, if they want to lower the price of the overall movie ticket, okay, and really the concession is a part of that, they'll give discounts on the popcorn, or they'll have popcorn, if you buy popcorn, you get a free soda, and so on and so forth. Okay, or they'll have special discounts for students and so on. So entrepreneurs do adjust prices according to supply and demand. Sometimes we can't figure out exactly how they're doing it. Usually an economist can figure it out if he looks closely. Here's the question: does the dollar necessarily devalue as the money supply increases? You have to be careful because devalue is used in two ways. Okay. The way I'm using it today, I'm not talking about the foreign exchange value of the dollar. All I'm talking about is the price of the dollar in relation to the price of goods. So it's really a truism, okay? That is, the dollar is, the price of the dollar is the reciprocal of prices. So if it's $2 per dozen eggs, then the egg price of the dollar is one half. So if it goes to $4 per dozen eggs, then the egg price of dollars has to fall. The purchasing power of the dollar falls. It buys less eggs. It buys only one fourth of a dozen eggs, okay, instead of one half a dozen. So I'm using the word depreciate in that manner, okay? When we talk about the value of the dollar, now, it is true that when we have inflation and the value of the dollar starts to shrink, people in foreign countries will find that they can buy less with dollars, and eventually their demand for dollars will drop, and what will happen is that there'll be a devaluation, or really we call it a depreciation, of the dollar's value on the foreign exchange markets. That happens later, okay? And it doesn't have to happen to the same extent as the domestic depreciation. Okay. So again, let me just inflation is simply another word for depreciation. Inflation means prices going up. Depreciation means the value of the dollar going down because prices are going up and because the dollar buys less. Okay. So you can't really have one without the other. Okay, I will stop here and have a good evening, and thank you for attending. Thank you.